Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, I'm Georgia and welcome back for another episode in my mystery series, where today I have something a little bit different for you. A lot of people tend to refer to this case, the Texas Killing Fields, as that of an unsolved serial killer, but it's actually a lot more complex than that. The Texas Killing Fields refers to a remote 25-ish acre area of land situated about a mile from Interstate Highway 45 near Galveston, Texas. Over the past five decades, there have been about 30 bodies of murder victims found within and around this area, all of the bodies being those of girls or young women, mostly aged between 15 to 25, with a few anomalies. There's also been additional women who have disappeared from this immediate area whose bodies have never been discovered. Now, if you're watching this video on YouTube, you'll notice that this is actually a fundraiser for Texas EquiSearch. So if you find yourself feeling charitable today, then a donation towards the cause would very much be appreciated. But as always, there's no pressure to do so. You'll find out eventually why Texas EquiSearch is relevant to this case and all of the amazing things they do. And also, you might have noticed from the title of this episode that this is actually going to be in two parts, which is something I've never done before. The reasons for this are threefold. One, we are still plagued by internet troubles in this new house. BT are hopefully fixing it. And whilst our internet can just about hack uploading a standard length video overnight, if this video is as long as I'm thinking it's going to be, she's gonna struggle, and whilst not uploading, we can't do anything else, like we can't even watch Netflix because it takes up all the bandwidth, and my girlfriend also needs to be able to work, so that's reason number one. Reason number two, we recently got a kitten, and she is so needy. My girlfriend's currently at work, so it's just me home alone with her trying to look after her, and she's literally like a toddler. She needs all of my attention all the time, so filming for 4+ hours just isn't very doable. You might be able to hear her, literally, she's running around in the hallway right now like a crazy person, and she's literally already been climbing the windows. I literally mean climbing up the window whilst I've been trying to film this, and I've only been doing it for 2 minutes. So that's reason number two. And reason number three, March is a five Wednesday month, and in five Wednesday months I usually still only upload 4 mystery videos. So instead of just missing the week next week as I originally planned, you're just gonna get an extra video instead. I get told I over explain things, but better to be safe than sorry. In part one today, we're going to cover the Texas Killing Fields throughout the 70s and talk about a couple of suspects. Part two will be up next week, where we'll be talking about the 80s up until now. The I-45 is a major highway running within Texas that connects the cities of Dallas and Houston, before continuing on to Galveston and ending there near the coast. It's the southern end of the highway where the so-called killing fields are located a mile away, next to a town called League City and bordering the Calder oil field. Locals call it the Calder 3000 block as it's positioned below 3000 Calder Road. It's worth bearing in mind as we go through the video that not every victim I'm going to be mentioning was found specifically on this 25-acre patch of land. A lot of them were, but there are a few which were found in different areas, but the circumstances around their disappearances or deaths tie in with others found specifically on the fields, and so their names have been kind of tied in. As an investigator told CBS in 2012, the killing field has become a symbol for all those girls that have gone missing up and down the I-45 corridor. This case is a complicated web of murder and disappearances, and to add another layer of complication, even though the names are all sort of tied in together, no one necessarily thinks that just one serial killer is responsible for all the deaths here. The FBI believe that multiple serial killers have used this area as a dumping ground for their victims over the past 50 years. Some say there's two killers, some say four, some say more. There could be multiple serial killers and then a few lone killers responsible for a single death, all choosing this area as the ideal place to dump their bodies. It could be one killer, but that's very unlikely. But what specifically is it about this area that calls to killers? Quite simply, this is a marshy stretch of land with not much going on in the local area. The oil fields were abandoned and the land up to the interstate is essentially wasteland, but it is easy to get to. You jump off the interstate, drive for a couple of minutes, and boom, acres and acres of deserted land. As one Texan journalist from the area told CBS in an interview, it's a kind of environment that's sultry and sinister, easy to get to. You jump off the I-45, you drive down one of the dirt-rutted roads, you dump the body, and you're gone for good. If you found yourself being hunted in these fields, nobody would hear you if you yelled. If you ran away, there's nowhere to run to. It's just a vast expanse of dead land. There's no one there to help you. It only makes sense that in the mind of a killer, this would be the ideal place to dump a body. And this area also falls under three separate jurisdictions, finding itself in the middle of three small towns and three counties, each with its own sheriff's department and police force. This made investigations much more complicated, with communication not as good as you'd hope it would be. And on top of all of that, I'm sure once this area started to become notorious for being a dumping ground, more killers would think to use it for their own crimes. It's an endless cycle, but a cycle that has seemed to die down in recent years. The last crime deemed to come under the title of Texas Killing Fields seems to come from 2006. This case is one which I found particularly hard to research. There are so many victims, so many suspects and convictions, so many details that are easy to get confused. So, in true Georgia style, I made a spreadsheet detailing everything. Names, ages, dates of disappearance, where they disappeared, where their bodies were found, any important information, any suspects and or convictions. Any information I can find is on my spreadsheet. So in case you guys get confused as well, I'm going to link my spreadsheet down below, probably via Google Docs or something, so you can also keep track of the names and stories of the victims. It's nothing super professional, but it has proved super helpful for me being able to keep track of the stories I was telling throughout this video. I mean, even the list of victims is questioned in this case. Some think more women should be added to the list, some think less. There might be names I missed out that you think should have been on there, or names I've added that you think shouldn't be. That's what makes this case so complicated. It is not cut and dry, and there's a lot of question around everything. I also find it really hard to figure out how to tell this story. Do I do it chronologically as the timeline happened in terms of disappearances? Or do I just group the girls together, tell their stories all in one? But then the timeline would get confusing, dates and names all jumbled. So I've gone for a combination of the two because that made most sense in my head. I also just want to give a quick shout out to my main source for my research for this video. This book is Catherine Casey's Deliver Us, Three Decades of Murder and Redemption in the Infamous I-45 Texas Killing Fields. This is pretty much the only extensive account I could find of these crimes. It was published in January 2015, so it is a little bit outdated, but any more modern articles on this case pretty much all pull from this source. This is the OG, and it's actually a really good read. It's one of the best true crime books I've ever read. The rest of my sources will also be linked down below, of course, but I highly recommend reading this book if you are interested in this case. It is really, really good. The sad story of the Texas Killing Fields begins back in June 1971 with 13-year-old Colette Wilson. She was from Alvin, which is about 17 kilometres southwest of the fields, and she disappeared when her band director dropped her off at the side of the road in Alvin on the corner of Highway 6 and a country road. The intention was that Colette would get picked up here by her mother, but her mother arrived at 12:36 p.m. just 6 minutes after Colette had been dropped off, and there was no sign of her. Although there was a car parked alongside the road with a man inside, but Colette's mum didn't think much of this at the time, assuming the man had just broken down and was waiting for somebody himself. In the past, when her mum had been late or she had been worried, Colette had just gone to her best friend's house down the road to wait there. So her mum drives there to check, but of course, she wasn't there either. At this point, her mum's very concerned and calls everyone they know to see if anybody had heard from her daughter. And eventually, she has to call the authorities to report Colette as missing. But of course, they just dub Colette a runaway, even telling her mum that she's probably off taking drugs, and they do basically nothing to search for her. So the family have to take matters into their own hands, and they organise multiple searches over the coming weeks to no avail. By the time the authorities took the disappearance seriously, it was too late. There were no clues, no answers, but her family knew that something bad must have happened to her. Colette was only 13 years old. 2 weeks later, on the 11th of July 1961, 14-year-old Brenda Jones goes missing from Galveston, Texas, only 32 miles east of Alvin, where Colette had gone missing. Brenda was a good student, she was outspoken, and wanted to be a teacher one day. She disappeared whilst walking in the east end of Galveston Island, and her family didn't have a car, so Brenda would walk and catch the bus everywhere, and this day was no exception. Her aunt was in hospital with a broken leg, and Brenda wanted to go visit her, so her mum gave her money for the bus fare. Brenda definitely arrived at the hospital that day, and the bus driver remembered her getting on the bus back home. But after she got off at her stop, just moments away from her home, she wasn't seen alive again. Her sister called the police and tried to report her as missing later that evening, but of course, they wouldn't take it seriously. However, her body was found the very next day in Galveston Bay near Pelican Island, just floating on the water. Brenda was found by a crew of workers who were painting the bridge, and it didn't take long for her to be identified, as an officer who arrived on the scene actually recognised her, he knew her. The autopsy showed that she had died from manual strangulation. The laces of the sandals she'd been wearing had been used to bind her wrists and ankles, and she was found completely nude. Some women's underwear, I assume Brenda's own, was found stuffed inside her mouth. 19-year-old Gloria Gonzalez disappeared on the 28th of October 1971 from Houston. She was a bookkeeper at the Houston Kroger grocery store, and she'd taken some much needed time off work, but she would disappear on the first day of that time off. Her roommate reported her as missing when she failed to return home, and she was last seen walking near her apartment on Jacqueline Street in Houston. Then 14-year-old Rhonda Johnson, known as Renee to everyone, and 13-year-old Sharon Shaw would go missing on the 4th of August from Harris County, Texas. The girls were best friends who had just spent the day together at Galveston Beach. They were said to be tomboys and totally fearless surfers. They were these proper cool girls. It's said that there's not a sport that Sharon couldn't do well, and if Sharon could do it, then Renee would do it as well. The girls originally had plans that day to go to the water ski school, but once they arrived, they were told that the weather conditions just weren't right for it. It was too windy. So instead, they just chilled on the beach for the day. They hung out with friends at the beach, and a girl called Glenda offered them a lift home, but they weren't ready to go yet. Glenda last saw them on Seawall Boulevard in front of the flagship hotel. At 5:30 p.m, Glenda headed back to that spot to pick the girls up and take them home. I think they all had plans to hang out at Glenda's house that night, but they weren't there waiting. By 6 p.m, Glenda had to get home, so she left, and wasn't all too worried when Sharon and Renee didn't turn up at her house at all. They were notoriously free spirits. In fact, none of their friends were all that concerned immediately when it became clear they'd disappeared. For weeks, the pair had been talking about running away to California to surf, so it was kind of just assumed they'd done that. They hadn't. Their families were much more concerned though, and they searched everywhere they could think of for the girls, but they were gone. On the 9th of November 1971, 12-year-old Allison Craven disappeared from her home in Houston. Her mum had to pop out to run some errands for an hour, leaving Allison home alone. But when she returned, Allison was gone. Just 6 days later, on the 15th of November, 15-year-old best friends Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson also went missing. Debbie and Maria were very similar to Renee and Sharon. They were both keen surfers who often attended the water ski school at Galveston Beach. And where you'd find one girl, you'd always find the other. They were inseparable. That day, Maria and Debbie were last seen in a Baskin and Robbins ice cream store at the Galveston Port Holiday Mall by a couple of classmates who called them over to chat. One of the friends would recall seeing the two girls hitchhike a lift as they walked away. A white man pulled up in a white van with a peace sticker on the back window. He pulled down his driver's window to talk to Maria, and then both the girls climbed into the van. Neither girl would return home, and the next day the families would alert the Texas Rangers. Police would release a be on the lookout alert for them, and their bodies were discovered fairly quickly. Just 2 days later, on the 17th of November, an elderly man who was fishing in Turner's Bayou in Texas City would call in an alert that he'd found a body. When officers arrived, they fished out the partially submerged body of Maria, nude from the waist down, and just like Brenda before her, her wrists and ankles were bound. But unlike Brenda, her cause of death was a gunshot wound, one on the right side of the neck and one in the centre. It was estimated that Maria had been in the water for about 36 hours, suggesting that she'd been killed 10 to 18 hours after her and Debbie's disappearance. And with Maria's body discovered, it was only a matter of time until Debbie was found too. She was also nude from the waist down, her wrists and ankles bound. She also had gunshot wounds, one to her upper back and one to the right of the spine. Seeing as both girls were found with all of their jewellery on, robbery was quickly ruled out as a motive for the murders, meaning that the only explanation was sexual in nature. And then the disappearances stopped for a bit, leaving time for a number of bodies to be discovered. On the 23rd of November, the body of Gloria Gonzalez was found near Addicts Reservoir in West Houston by a man doing some metal detecting. According to Catherine Casey, he came across a decapitated, decomposing body. He alerts the police, who quickly find a skull nearby in the underbrush. Through the clothing found on the remains, it was quickly thought to be Gloria. The autopsy showed evidence that she'd been bludgeoned to death, but it would later be revealed that she was killed by ligature strangulation. And then, just a couple of days later, the body of Colette Wilson was found, just 50 yards from where Gloria had been. The discovery of Colette's body wasn't a surprise. In finding the remains of Gloria, investigators had picked up a molar that they believed belonged to her, but it didn't fit her skull. The pathologist concluded that there must be another body nearby, so 3 days later, investigators returned and found a pile of bones and a ring with the word peace on it, giving away Colette's identity almost immediately. It had been over 5 months since Colette had disappeared from that bus stop. Sadly, it would be her father who was responsible for formally identifying Colette's remains. He was the town dentist. He'd been the one responsible for Colette's dental care her whole life. Seeing as there were only skeletal remains left, basically the only way she could be identified was via her dental records, something only her dad would know. This whole situation was tragic. Her father would end up dying not long after from what a lot of articles said was a broken heart. And then 4 years later, the Wilsons' youngest son died when a friend reversed in the driveway, not realising he was behind the car. My heart goes out to that poor family. Colette's cause of death? Blunt force trauma, homicide. By this point, it was becoming very clear to law enforcement in Texas that they were dealing with something serious. The same person responsible for multiple disappearances and murders. They wouldn't have had the terminology to refer to the perpetrator as a serial killer at this point, but that's what they were dealing with. They started to interview and polygraph anyone suspicious, and the case started to receive national media attention. 7 girls dead or disappeared, and how had nobody noticed up until now? On the 3rd of January 1972, some teens were exploring the water of a drainage ditch attached to Taylor Bayou when they saw what they thought was a volleyball, but it was a skull, followed by the discovery of more bones, later identified as those of Renee Johnson. But as hard as investigators searched, they couldn't find Sharon's remains anywhere, and eventually they were forced to give up on the search. But about a month later, a passerby found another skull in the same area. Investigators would then find the rest of the remains nearby, which forensic experts would rule to be Sharon. The same as so many before them, they had both been bound at the hands and feet, and due to the condition of the remains, they would be unable to determine a cause of death. The medical examiner wrote that there were no signs of trauma, but due to the circumstances, they were under the opinion that the deaths were the result of homicide. Then, on the 25th of February 1971, the body of Alison Craven was found. The situation around the discovery of Alison's body isn't entirely clear to me. It seems that not long after her disappearance, some of her remains, including hands and arm bones, were found in a field not far from her home. And then in February, the rest of her remains were found in a field about 10 kilometres away from her home. And then, after the discovery of Alison, things went quiet for a while. There wouldn't be any more activity in the Texas killing fields until January 1973. So we're talking 11 months of silence, but over a year since the last girl disappeared. A lot of people group all of the girls I've mentioned already up to this point together, saying that perhaps all of them were killed by the same person, and then another person was perhaps inspired to continue in 1973. But even all of the cases I've spoken about up to this point vary greatly in terms of MO. You have gunshot wounds, strangulation, blunt force trauma. Some girls were found in the actual Texas killing field, some were found in water nearby. The only commonality between each case was the fact that they were all teenage girls who lived in the same kind of area, but even then they varied greatly in terms of appearance. And there was even a conviction in one of the cases I've mentioned, in the case of Sharon Shaw, which naturally brings us to talk about our first possible suspect in this case, Michael Lloyd Self. This is a very interesting conviction because although Sharon was killed alongside her best friend Renee Johnson, Self was only ever convicted in Sharon's murder. In the aftermath of Renee's murder, the Galveston authorities were put under a lot of pressure to get her case solved, as her grandfather was a prominent city council member and he did eventually become mayor. In late May 1972, a new police chief and an assistant chief were hired, Don Morris and Tommy Deal, and one of their main focuses became solving this case. They had to get it solved, they had to prove they deserved these new higher positions they'd been given, and they'd been given those jobs on the basis that they would solve the case. Just a few weeks into their jobs, there was a stroke of luck when they received a tip about a man called Michael Lloyd Self, a known sex offender who had been arrested before for being a peeping Tom, and was known by people who knew him as Slow Mike. He was shy, he struggled in school, and struggled to hold conversations. A doctor diagnosed him with a minimal brain injury as a child as an explanation. Michael Self was a 23-year-old gas station attendant, but it seems that he really wanted to be in law enforcement. He volunteered at the local fire station and would frequently hang out at the police station next door, befriending all the officers. He would learn about the local cases around town and would love to discuss them with anyone who would listen. But nothing big ever really happened in Webster, until the murders of Renee and Sharon. Not long after the new chief was appointed, Self attracted his attention when it was thought that he'd stolen some gas from the fire station. From there, what happened next was inevitable, whether Self was truly guilty or not. Chief Morris locked in on Michael Self and seemingly decided that he was the one responsible for the murders of Renee and Sharon. On the 9th of June, two officers, Tommy Deal and Herman Morgan, go and visit Self at 5 a.m. whilst he was working the night shift at the gas station. I have no doubt that going so late to see him into his night shift would have been a deliberate move on their behalf. He would have been tired and easier to get the information out of. And so Michael Self goes into the station for questioning at 7:30 a.m. after he clocked out of his shift. From the very beginning, this murder investigation was messed up. And by all accounts, by 9:30 a.m, Michael Self had confessed to the murders. To steal a passage directly from this book, what happened would later be recounted in depositions by other officers who ventured in and out of the interrogation room that day. They heard Morris shout at Self, who cowered handcuffed in a chair. At one point, witnesses said Morris held a billy club in his hand, hitting his palm with it whilst he cursed at Self, demanding the confession. Mike Self would later contend that Morris ran the stick into his abdomen and hit him across the back, telling him that he wouldn't get out of the interrogation room until he admitted to killing the girls. Self signed a confession and would later say that he had only signed because he was so afraid the police chief was going to kill him if he didn't. He was arrested that same morning for the murders of both Sharon and Renee, but they decided to go forward to trial for only the murder of Sharon. This way, if he was found not guilty, they could try it all over again for the murder of Renee. he was going to prison one way or another. But it became clear pretty quickly that nothing about the signed confession matched up with actual physical evidence at the scene of the crime. Self confessed that he put the girls' bodies into Taylor Lake, not Taylor Bayou. He said that he'd picked up one of the girls at her house, but she wasn't home at all that day. He said that he had beat the girls on the head with a Coke bottle, knocking them out, but neither of their skulls showed any evidence of trauma. He said that he removed their clothes and drove miles away to dispose of them, but their clothes were found very near to where their bodies had been found. Anyone could have looked at this confession and seen the very clear discrepancies, so why didn't they? But at the end of the day, who were people going to believe? The guy who's just signed a murder confession or an upstanding police chief? At trial, Michael Self was found guilty of the murder of Sharon Shaw and sentenced to life in prison for his crime. Some people today still believe Self to be guilty of this, but I think the general consensus is that he's not. He was framed in order to make Police Chief Don Morris look good at his job, which he weirdly resigned from just a couple of months after the trial. But Morris would prove to be his own downfall. In September 1975, a bank was robbed in a small town called Caddo Mills, men with guns and paper bags demanding money from the banker's drawers. But Caddo Mills was the kind of place where you weren't going to get away with this. As word spread about what was going on, the local community came together and literally chased the robbers as they escaped, eventually bringing them to a stop. So who were the robbers? None other than Tommy Deal, the assistant chief, and one of the officers who brought Michael Self in, and another former police officer. It would soon transpire that they were all part of a band of thieves run by none other than Police Chief Don Morris. This threw everything into question. They were clearly dirty cops. What else had they done? Despite Michael Self's appeal coming up in 1979, he would be denied and he would remain in prison until his death in 2000. Because if he was in prison, they didn't need to keep searching for the murder of Sharon and Renee. But with Self in prison, the murders didn't stop. After a 10-month lull in murders and body discoveries, 16-year-old Kimberly Ray Pitchford disappeared. That day was like any other for Kimberly. She'd attended high school, gone to a detention, and then headed to her 5 p.m. driver's ed lesson. The lesson was an hour long, and then she left to head home. By all accounts, Kimberly was a very responsible teenager. Her parents never had to worry about her. She didn't make stupid decisions, she wasn't unreliable. If a parent asked her to do something, she would do it. So when her mum told her to call home for a lift after driver's ed ended, she expected her to do so. But the call never came. Later that night, they reported her as missing. The family's panic wouldn't last for long, as her body was found just 2 days later. I never know if it's better or worse for a body to be found so soon after somebody goes missing. You want the family to have hope their loved one has just gone off for a bit, that soon they'll walk through the door. But I know if it was me, I'd rather a body be found as soon as possible just so you can start the process of grieving. I can imagine there's nothing worse than the limbo, but I digress. Kimberly was found in a bayou off a rural lane 22 miles from where she was last seen, and she was discovered by two teenage boys. They ran home to tell their fathers, one of whom came back with them to investigate before they decided to call the police. Kimberly was quick to identify as they found her driver's permit in her coat that was abandoned nearby. As with so many of the others I've mentioned, she was found still wearing her jewellery and her cause of death was determined to be ligature strangulation. A year and a half later, two more girls' friends go missing. 12-year-old Brooks Bracewell and 14-year-old Georgia Gear went missing on the 6th September 1974 after failing to turn up at school. They lived in a town called Dickinson along the I-45 and attended McAdams Junior High School. As far as I can remember, it's not mentioned in Catherine Casey's book, but several sources online state the girls were last seen at a U-Totem convenience store in Texas City. It was thought by their parents they'd just skipped school that day, and when the police were informed, they agreed, thinking it was another runaway case. A witness came forward saying they'd seen the girls at a motel near Alvin playing football with a group of men, and another witness said they'd seen the girls hitchhiking. It doesn't seem like there was all too much investigation to find them. Their bodies were found just over a year and a half later, on the 18th of April 1976. A worker at the Phillips oil site stumbled across two skulls, and the following search would be much more difficult than any of the others. There had been this big flood in this area the previous year, so the bodies had been displaced. Prisoners were brought in to help in the search, and over 4,000 man hours went into it, finding nothing more than teeth and a few bits of clothing. But all medical examiners needed were the skulls. The girls were identified through dental records, and it was determined that they had suffered blows to the head, likely the cause of their deaths. In April 1981, the rest of their remains would be found in a Brazoria County oil field just south of Alvin. On May 21st, 1977, 12-year-old Suzanne Bowers, known as Susie to everyone, left her grandparents' home near the Galveston seawall. She was going to walk home, put on a bathing suit, grab her bike, and then go to meet friends on Seawall Boulevard, which, if you remember, is the last place that Sharon and Renee were seen. But Susie would never arrive. In fact, she didn't even arrive back to her parents' house from her grandparents. At some point on the short walk, she disappeared. That evening, her parents reported her as missing. And shockingly, despite the amount of teenage girls that had gone missing in the area over the last few years and had turned up dead, police still refused to take it seriously, brushing off Susie as a runaway, despite her parents telling them that just wasn't her. All her clothes and money were still at home, none of her friends had disappeared, and she was just 12 years old. Where was she running away to? But their pleas fell on deaf ears. 2 years later, in March 1979, two teenage boys would come across Susie's remains in Alvin, not far from where Colette Wilson had disappeared all those years earlier, and also not far from where the skulls of Georgia Gear and Brooks Bracewell had been found. Not long after this, notorious serial killer Henry Lee Lucas confessed to killing Susie, and the case was all but closed after this point. But the problem is that Henry Lee Lucas confessed to killing everyone. He said he killed hundreds of people, and he just didn't. He would later say that he only confessed to killing Susie because the authorities would reward him for each confession. It was false. He wasn't the one responsible, but that was it. Law enforcement just didn't really care anymore. Which brings us to our next suspect, one which I think has much more credibility than Michael Self. Edward Howard Bell, known mostly as just Ed Bell. In all honesty, the story of Ed Bell could be a whole video of its own. There's even a whole documentary called The 11 about his relation to the Texas killing fields. So I'm going to try my best to keep to the most relevant points here. Ed Bell was born in Houston in 1937 and would move around a lot as a kid following his father's job in the oil fields. It's said that as a kid, he witnessed his cousin kill his uncle, and it seems that the effects of that would reverberate throughout the rest of his life. But despite this, most people who knew Bell said that he was a good kid who grew into a good man. He was smart and had plenty of friends. Nobody who knew him ever said he had any signs of a temper or being volatile, and he eventually got married, having three children. But in 1966, he was arrested for the first time and sent to a psychiatric facility when he was caught exposing himself to young girls. The treatment wouldn't help, and from then on, Ed would be arrested multiple times for the same crime and would eventually move to Galveston, where apparently he fell in love with the water. He would frequent a surf shop on the beach that he would later become a part owner of, the same surf shop it was known that many of the previous victims would visit. One of Ed's employees at this surf shop lived behind Susie Bowers' house, and it was known that he would go and visit this employee at home very often. In February 1972, Bell would be arrested for exposing himself once again, this time in Louisiana. Interestingly, the vehicle he drove at this time was noted by the officers, a white Ford van, very similar to the van that Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson were seen getting into before they disappeared. Sharon Shaw and Renee Wilson were also known to have been hanging out with some older men in the weeks before their disappearance. Sadly, older men preying on teenage girls isn't something completely unheard of. It could have been anyone. But Bell did live in this area at the time, and he was known to have a proclivity towards younger girls. It was known by their friends that one of these men they were seeing drove a van. and the ski school that Renee and Sharon had visited the morning they disappeared, that was just down the block from Belle's apartment. It's also worth noting that the events on Galveston Island specifically started very soon after Belle was released from his latest psychiatric program for his sexual perversions in July 1970. This could all be coincidence, of course, there's no hard evidence of anything, but it was definitely enough to point the finger in Belle's direction. Tenuous links could even be made to the rest of the girls, Colette, Brenda, Gloria. But of course, a lot of these connections wouldn't be made for many, many years, not until an officer called Fred Page heard Belle's name and started to do the math. At this time in the 70s, Belle was just an unknown, just another sex offender. His name wasn't connected with the case at all. His name was first raised in connection with the killing fields in the late 1990s. In 1993, Belle was convicted of the murder of a man called Larry Dickens in 1978, when he pulled up outside a house in Pasadena, Texas, got out of his truck, undressed from the waist down, and started masturbating in front of a group of children. A 26-year-old marine vet in the neighbourhood heard what was going on and confronted Belle, grabbing the keys from the ignition of his truck in an effort to stop him leaving before the police arrived. Belle grabbed a gun from his truck and shot Larry 4 times in the chest. Larry stumbled back up the driveway to the house and Belle grabbed a rifle this time and shoots him again, ending his life. The police arrived and arrested Belle after a short car chase, but his lawyer quickly posted bond. But if they arrested him so quickly, how come he wasn't convicted of the murder for another 15 years? Well, he ran. For 14 years, he evaded capture and was named one of Texas's most wanted criminals, until America's Most Wanted featured an episode on him, with Matthew McConaughey playing Larry Dickens in his first ever acting role. The episode led to lots of tips, which prompted authorities to find Belle in Panama, and he finally stood trial soon after and was eventually handed down a 70-year prison sentence. It was 5 years after that that the connection to the killing fields would be made, when Belle sent a letter to the Harris and Galveston County prosecutors claiming to have killed 7 girls in Galveston County and 4 in Harris County, including 2 15-year-old girls from Galveston, who he says he shot as they stood tied up and half-naked in Turner Bayou. The girls in question, Debbie Ackerman and Maria Johnson. The details he gave of the killing in this letter did match the evidence found at the scene. He claimed that he had been brainwashed into becoming a killer, and if he was ever brought to court for these crimes, he would plead not guilty. This letter was from 1998, but it quickly faded into nothing when the authorities tried to follow up and he went silent. The DA just thought it was a false confession. One former Galveston DA, Kurt Sistruck, told the Houston Chronicle, "I didn't believe we had sufficient evidence that we could proceed to grand jury with, and without getting into specifics, that's the decision that had to be made, no matter the temptations to proceed otherwise. It wasn't for a lack of effort." It wasn't until 2006 that the aforementioned officer, Fred Page, set out on his mission to get answers to the case of Maria and Debbie. He spoke to a senior officer called Cara Costello, who recalled this letter from Ed Belle all those years earlier, so he dug up. From there, Page was like a dog with a bone. How could this have been ignored for so many years? He started to work the case, making all the connections to the other 70s murders I mentioned previously. That same year, Page ran a piece in the Houston County Police News naming Belle as a suspect and asking any other officers to come forward with information on him, particularly if they had photos of the white van Belle drove at the time. Page was hoping to find a photo of a peace sticker that should have been on there, as was on the back of the van that Debbie and Maria got into that day. In 2011, a Houston Chronicle reporter called Lisa Olson corresponded with Belle in prison, and he wrote that he murdered 11 girls, 5 in 1971 and 6 more in the mid to late 70s. He called them the 11 that went to heaven. And he even gave some names, Colette Wilson, Debbie Ackerman, Maria Johnson, Sharon Shaw and Renee Johnson. He then went on to name Kimberly Pitchford, just calling her by her surname, and then 2 more girls who had died together. Although he didn't name them, it's thought he was referring to Brooks Bracewell and Georgia Gear. By this point, Paige had already discovered that Belle owned pasture land very close to where Brooks and Georgia were last seen. He also made reference to a dark-haired girl thought to have maybe been Gloria Gonzalez. Many Texas investigators have said that Belle is the closest thing they've ever had to an answer in this case. But in the state by this point, confessions alone couldn't be used to convict anyone in a court of law. And for good reason, just refer back to Michael Self's story. There needed to be actual evidence that Belle was responsible for these murders, and seeing as it was now 2011, a lot of the evidence had been lost. But it's not out of the question that Belle had simply learned the names of the Killingfields victims up to this point and was using them for attention. Serial killers are known to do that. If they just took him at his word, they could be missing something important. They could miss another killer out there roaming the streets. They can't just believe him, there has to be evidence, and there just isn't that. Chapter 6 of Deliver Us actually features Catherine Casey going to talk to Belle in prison, and it's a really fascinating look inside this man's head. On the outside, he seems mentally ill, possible psychosis, and there's no doubt that he was in and out psychiatric hospitals a lot over the years. But there's also the vibe that this could all just be a very smart act. Honestly, I really can't recommend this book enough, so please go and read it if you want a really deep dive into this case. The culmination of this part of the story is unsatisfying for everyone involved. Belle died in prison in April 2019, he was 82 years old, and he never provided any solid answers. We still don't know if he was responsible for the murders. He's definitely a good suspect, but there's nothing solid. It also doesn't help that Susie Bowers was definitely not the last victim to be found in the killing fields. The murders continued long after Belle went on the run in 1978. But was it the same person responsible? And that's where I'm going to end part one of this video. I think I made the right decision because this alone has taken me ages to film. I'm so sorry about my cat being very annoying. I know she's making noise. And the wind, but I can't control the weather and I've got to film this today, so I apologise, but hopefully I'm going to be able to edit this into something okay. I've just realised that I didn't actually get to the part of my script where I talk about Texas Equisearch and all of the amazing things they do, but don't worry, that will be coming up early next week. Just trust me, they're a non-profit organisation that align with what we're trying to do here on this channel, and they very closely link with this story. If you want to go ahead and do a little bit of research on them anyway, I will leave their website linked in the description box down below, just in case. Thank you so much for tuning in this week. Please come back for part two next week, and I guess I'll see you there. Bye guys.